Welcome to Two Bees in a Podcast, brought to you by the Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory at the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. It is our goal to advance the understanding of honeybees and beekeeping, grow the beekeeping community, and improve the health of honeybees everywhere. In this podcast, you'll hear research updates, beekeeping management practices discussed, and advice on beekeeping from our resident experts, beekeepers, scientists, and other program guests. Join us for today's program, and thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast. Hello, and welcome to this episode of Two Bees in a Podcast. In our first segment, we will be talking with Dr. Ben Oldroyd, who is a professor from the University of Sydney in Australia. He will be discussing his new research on how to use drones at drone congregation areas to estimate the density of wild honeybee colonies. We will follow that with a segment on Nosema, where we'll be interviewing Dr. Cameron Jack from the University of Florida, who's an expert on the topic. And of course, no two bees in a podcast is complete without our famous question and answer segment. Welcome to this segment on Two Bees in a Podcast. I'm really excited for today's guest. He's Dr. Ben Oldroyd, who's a professor in behavioral genetics, the School of Life and Environmental Sciences at the University of Sydney in Australia. But he's not actually joining us from Australia today. He's actually joining us from Berlin, Germany, where he is on a 10-month sabbatical in the Institute of Advanced Studies in Berlin. Dr. Oldroyd, thank you so much for joining us on Two Bees in a Podcast.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
Absolutely. So
Was that supposed to be punny?
Of course it was, right, Amy? So the thing is we're recording this in early September 2020. So Ben has just arrived about a month ago in Germany, and I was fortunate to do a sabbatical in Germany as well. And while he's there, he mentioned to us beforehand, Ben, that you were saying that you just have to go there and think and interact with other scientists. That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, it's sort of like a holiday camp for academics. It's really fantastic.
That's great. Well, you know, we're going to talk a lot about what we brought you on today. You're going to be telling us about some research project that you and a student did on using drones to discover the density of wild honeybee colonies. But Ben, before we get there, I really like to introduce our listeners to the interviewee. So could you tell us just very briefly how you got into bee research, how you ended up where you are, what institutions you passed through along the way, et cetera?
Okay. So I grew up in the early part of my life up until age 9 in New Zealand. And I grew up on an orchard, and they had some bees there. And I was absolutely fascinated by the bees, and would sit there and watch them come and go and catch them on clover plants and wonder why they didn't make any honey, et cetera, et cetera. And then my parents moved to Australia when I was 9, and I got into Boy Scouts, and by 11, I had 2 or 3 beehives, and I've never looked back. I did an agriculture degree at Sydney University, studied genetics because I wanted to breed better bees. And then I got interested in sort of bee behavior and all that sort of thing. So that's become my career. I study the genes which affect behavior of honeybees.
I saw that you did sometime at the Baton Rouge Bee Lab, the USDA lab there. Were you there for a postdoc or doing a degree, or was it employment?
I was employed as a research scientist.
Really?
It was a fantastic experience. I had a great deal of mentoring from John Harbo and Tom Rinderer. Had a wonderful time and learned a lot. Very grateful for my years in the Baton Rouge Bee Lab. I was there for about 4 years, I think.
Yeah, I saw that. That's really neat. I don't think I was aware of that. That's pretty cool that you were able to do that.
I was a running mate of John Harbo.
So, you know, I did my undergraduate at the University of Georgia, where I worked in the lab of Keith Delaplane. And Keith Delaplane, of course, was a student of John Harbo and speaks very highly of him. And we interviewed Jeff Harris a few weeks ago, and he was talking about John Harbo.
I feel like we need to bring John Harbo. Yeah.
So.
We need to bring him onto the podcast, I think.
Yeah, you do. World's greatest inseminator. Amazing. I've seen him inseminate a queen bee, take out the semen from the spermatheca, and inseminate her daughter. And I think he did that for two generations.
That's incredible.
What? That is so cool. Okay. So we're going to have to interview him for podcast and get a video recording of him sometime. Life goals. Okay. So when I had reached out to you, Dr. Ben, I asked you, you know, about different topics that you'd want to talk about. And you had mentioned using trapped drones to discover the density of wild honeybee colonies, which is kind of funny because I feel like we haven't really talked a lot about drones in a lot of our other podcasts, but just recently I've been speaking to different associations throughout the state and they've been asking me a lot about drones. So I think that they're going to really enjoy this segment and this will kind of be the beginning of a lot of, I think, drone episodes that we could talk about in the future. But I guess we just wanted to talk about your research and, you know, what was kind of the backstory behind this research? What was the motivation behind it? Who was involved? And, you know, what did it really involve and entail?
Yeah, okay. So the number of bee colonies or wild bee colonies that are out there is of great interest, of course. You might have all sorts of reasons for wanting to know how many colonies are around you, but I'll give you a few. If you were a farmer, you might want to know if there's enough bees out there to pollinate your, you know, your orchard or whatever. But you might want to know whether you need to rent colonies because there's not enough wild bees out there to pollinate your crop, or you might want to say, well, I don't have to because there's plenty of wild bees around. So that's one motivation. Another one might be if you have a new exotic disease outbreak, you'd like to know how many colonies are out there and whether it would be feasible to go out mm-hmm. there, find them all and kill them. If you're doing rebreeding and you want to use controlled mating of some sort and you don't want to use AI, you want to know how many colonies are out there. So there's lots and lots of reasons for wanting to know how many colonies that are out there. One more would be some people are concerned about feral bees adversely affecting the environment. So again, sure. You know how many colonies are out there. So how do you do it? You know, you can't attract the workers to a site and study them because, you know, they come from all over the place. You don't know how far they've come. So that's not going to work. And wandering around in the forest looking for bee colonies is, you know, while it's fun, is a little bit hit and miss. You might see them, you know,
yeah,
right up in the top of a tree and you can't see them. Actually, I'll tell you the story. I once did a study with wayward youth from Europe in Wipperfell National Park in Australia. So they were part of a trust that sent people to Australia to do environmental work. And I got 10 of these volunteers and we walked around in the national park to find all the feral colonies that we could. And we found 120 colonies per square kilometre. So you can't do that on your own. You've got to have volunteers, and of course it gets very expensive and difficult. So you can do it a different way, and the different way is to have the drones from every colony come to you. So how do you do that? Well, you get a helium balloon, a weather balloon, and you lift up this trap gizmo, which is basically like a windsock at an airport. And you raise that up, and inside it, you've got some cigarette filters, which you've made black, and you squirt queen pheromone onto those cigarette filters, and all the drones in the area smell this, and they're attracted to them, and they go into the net. So then you've got, and you can collect hundreds of drones in a few minutes if you've got the right spot.
Did you come up with this method, or is this a method that's commonly used?
This is not a commonly used method.
That's okay.
By John Williams at the Baton Rouge Bee Lab, actually, many years ago. But all he was interested in was trapping them. He didn't really know what to do with them afterwards. So that was back in the days with Africanized bees. We were terribly concerned about Africanized bees. And the notion was that you trap the drones and then you put some insecticide on them and they'd fly back to their nest and the nest would die. That would be a good way to get rid of feral bees. But we thought, and other people have thought, that it would be a great idea to catch the drones and then you'd be able to do some genetics on them and find out how many colonies they came from. So if you've got 300 drones in your trap, you genetically analyse them and you find there are 30 groups of brothers, then you know that 30 colonies were sending drones to your trap. So that's the gist of what we do. So the difficulty with that is you have to get the area right. You have to know how far the drones come. Mm-hmm. And so we've been doing lots of experiments on that. And one I'd like to share with you is where we took a colony of bees from Sydney University that we built up to have lots and lots of drones in it. And we took them over the mountains in Sydney to where it was still quite cold last spring. And then we put our balloon up 250 metres from the colony and caught some drones. And we painted all the drones in this colony white. So we knew on the 250 metres, they fly at least 250 metres. So then we went 500 metres on the other side of the colony and put up our balloon and collected some drones and did this in a pendulum fashion, backwards and forwards, until we worked out that the drones fly, wait for it, 3.75 kilometres. So that's how far drones will fly from their colony, and you can track them with this track. So that makes an area of 42 square kilometres that you draw your drones from. So if you find your, say there's 30 groups of brothers in your track doing your genetics on them, then that means that you can divide 30 by 42 and you've got slightly less than one colony per square kilometre.
So that's pretty fascinating, Ben. So this has been a topic that has interested me as well. I had a master's student go down to South Africa, and we were just trying to look at indexing, not actual estimating colony densities, but just an index, you know, based on workers at feeders, you know, we're getting large volumes or not. Of course, that's problematic because if you're too close to a colony, they could be overzealous for that honey and lead to problems. But the drone thing I'd seen before there, I'm really intrigued by this, and I've got 1,000 questions, but I'll try to keep it to just one or two for the sake of the podcast. But I'm curious with regard to this system, what is your overall average density of colonies per square kilometer?
It varies a lot, but we usually find that we collect about 100 colonies in our trap, and then okay. You divide that by 42.
So it's about two point something.
Yeah.
So I have a silly question.
Yeah.
Do the drones communicate the same way that the workers communicate when they're out foraging? Is that how they...
So drones aren't out foraging. They're going out to mate at these DCAs. So that's what they're collecting them at.
But do they communicate like workers do when workers are out foraging, like with the waggle dance?
Nope. No. Ben, you can answer that one for me.
Well, they don't dance.
They don't dance.
They do not dance. There's one species where they do a kind of proto dance. That's Apocendranophormes in Thailand and places like that. These little bees, the drones, do a dance, but what they're doing there is just encouraging each other to take off.
Okay.
Let's go. Let's get this. It's like the pre-game warm up, right?
Okay. Right, exactly like that.
Yeah. So Ben, I'm intrigued. I want to follow up my question about the varying densities with this question here. So my interest in it years ago, I haven't done much with it since, was to be able to estimate the quality of an environment and its ability to support colonies based on the density of wild or feral colonies. So do you have any insights to that, or is it a little premature in the research where, for example, you're seeing on highly managed land, you have lower densities, and on, say, maybe more natural land, you have higher densities of wild colonies, or vice versa? Are you heading there? Have you already done some preliminary work on this?
We have actually done that in Australia. We got matched sites. So, an area which has got pretty pristine environment, and then an area which has been farmed outside it and has been cleared for agriculture. And it's consistent that you always find more colonies in the natural areas than you do out in the farming areas, which is interesting since honeybees are not native to Australia, but they still seem to be attracted to the preserved habitats.
Yeah, that is interesting. I thought about that again from the U.S. perspective, but I think we probably find something very similar. I think we'd find a higher density. Well, that said, we have African bees in the southern half of our state, and the density is incredibly high in urban areas, just really, really high. So let me ask you then, what level of differences are you seeing in the density, say, between your natural areas and your farmed areas, or is it too early to tell for sure? Is it like a 2-to-1 ratio or 1.5-to-1 ratio?
Yeah, it's about that, about 2-to-1.
Okay, that's incredible.
It's not 10 times. But we do have the world record, I think, for honeybee colony densities in Weipperfeld National Park. That's where I did the study with the wayward youth from Europe. We got 160 colonies per square kilometer.
What?
That is in miles. That's about 300, isn't it?
That's crazy.
That's incredible. So how in the world were there enough resources to support that density? That's just incredible. Well,
this was in a habitat that was along a creek. So there were these big old red gum trees along the creek, which were full of hollows. And many of those trees had 4 or 5 colonies in them. But the surrounding habitat was quite deserty.
Huh.
So even though there was probably nectar resources out there, there was nowhere for the bees to live. So they were attracted to this line of trees, and that's where we were doing our transect. So it's probably a little bit, of an exaggeration of the overall number of colonies in the area. And they had an incredible propensity for this population to fluctuate. So in 1 year, it was down to about 50 colonies per square kilometre in a drought, and then the other year it was up around 160. So they have amazing capacity to increase and decrease in population size.
Huh, that's so crazy. So I guess a lot of our listeners always want to know, how can this research be applied? So how can this be applied to them or to other beekeepers around them? Or I guess we have a lot of calls just about feral colonies in general and wild colonies in general. So how would this be applied to them?
As we talked about at the beginning, it's of great interest as to the number of colonies in an area for whether or not there's enough colonies to pollinate your crops, whether you can muster enough resources to go in there and eradicate colonies if there's a new disease outbreak. I mean, we're terrified in Australia of varroa, but if you were in an area where there was 150 colonies per square kilometre, there's no way that you're going to be able to eradicate.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Whereas if you estimated that it was only 1 or 2, you might have a chance over a reasonable area. So and you can sometimes tell whether or not there is varroa because I guess you'd find them on the drones. So there's great potential for using this technique for monitoring disease outbreaks. I'll tell you a little story. You may be aware, or your listeners may be aware, that we have Apis serrana now in Australia. This is the Asian honeybee from which varroa came. And it has established a wild population in Cairns, which is a northern city in Queensland in Australia. And then there's been a second outbreak in Townsville, which is a small city 400 kilometres south of Cairns. So we've got the main infestation and there's another one, which is in the south. And they got in there, and to their great credit, they eradicated it. But then it came back. And there's two ways that we detected them. One was by looking at the poo of bee-eater birds. So you can see the wings of the bees.
That's great.
Poo. Well, you say poop, don't you?
Well, I'll tell you what.
poo-poo.
For purposes of everybody, we're talking about feces here.
Right.
Poo is a scientific term, though. That's okay.
And the other way was we put up the balloons to attract the drones of this species. And that was the first way that the second infestation was detected by the balloons. So there's another application using it to detect invasive species, new species coming into.
So that's interesting. Are the drones from Serrana attracted to the same pheromone that you use for drones of mellifera?
Yeah, they are attracted just as much, but they're very shy. So whereas with mellifera, if you put your balloon up, the drones just mob the thing. You can see hundreds and hundreds of them chasing each other and going up into the trap. But Serrana are different. They're very shy and they hide in the trees. Actually, we think they may even sit on the leaves in the trees, and then they dart out and look at your lures. But they won't actually go into the trap, so because they're too shy, they're too scared of this big thing up there. So what we eventually ended up doing was getting, you know, fly paper, the sticky glue on fly paper. So we would smear the nylon line that was holding up the lures with this sticky stuff, and they would bang into it and get stuck on it, and then you'd lower down.
That's so fun.
It's awfully good fun, but you get terribly sticky. You don't want to be wearing your best dress when you're doing that.
So one of the things I'd like to ask, Ben, you've already talked a little bit about some other projects that one could do with it. For example, attracting Serrano, we just finished talking about that. But I'm wondering, what are some other future implications? Of course, you've talked about the applicability to beekeepers, but I'm thinking about things like bioindicators. Can you look at the density of feral or wild honeybee colonies to get an indication of the quality of the environment or the ability of the environment to support, say, commercial beekeepers or other pollinators? Can you use it to establish information about conservation status, et cetera? So where are some directions that you see this heading?
Well, I think everything you say is completely right. So, for example, after the recent bushfires in Australia, as you might have heard about at the beginning of this year, we had terrible fires. And we did some studies, post-fire to see whether we could detect any colonies. And it was remarkable how many bees were still out there. Colonies were still out there after these devastating fires, which you would have thought would have killed everything. So that was a bit of an eye-opener that we still found lots of drones after the fires. The other thing that we've been doing, this is kind of a fun thing, at Sydney University we have our sports oval, our number one sports oval, which is a drone congregation area. So this is where the drones
naturally go. That's great.
Every afternoon. And if you go down there, I discovered this in 1980, that shows you how old I am. And if you go down there and throw a stone in the air, the drones will approach it and try and mate with it. That's how many drones are there. We do an animal behavior crack at that place with our animal behavior students, where they put the balloons up and estimate how many colonies are in the area. It's a very fun afternoon, as you might imagine. Six balloons in the air with all these students running around. We put this balloon up at this oval and another one in outer Sydney every month for 2 years and analyze the colonies that were there. And it's absolutely fascinating. You can trace the demography of the population. You can see this one swarmed. This one died. This is a new one. This is the daughter of that one. And you don't know where they are, but this whole story you can piece together just by looking at the drones. It's fascinating.
That's really cool, because I've often wondered about the relatedness of colonies in an area. So I really think that what you're doing there and that example that you just gave is a good example of how you can do that. And you can see, just like what you said, demography, how things change over time, the relatedness of these colonies in the environment. That's really neat. You had mentioned early on, though, that you really wanted to make sure and give some credit to the student who did a lot of this work with you. Can you tell us a little bit about that student?
Yeah. So the main one who's with us now, and she's about to submit her PhD, is, wait for this name, it's Patsy V. Utaipanom. She is from Thailand and she's been with us for 3 years and she's absolutely amazing. Loves getting out there catching drones. She's been all over the country catching drones and bringing them back to the lab and doing amazing genetics on them and developing new techniques of statistical analysis of them to infer these things. She's just a fabulous person.
Wow, that's exciting. I can tell you, as a supervisor of students myself, it's always great to get those students who are able to do these things that are cutting edge and lead to these great new discoveries. So, Ben, I really appreciate you joining us from Berlin today. It's been great to have you on this podcast.
It's been my pleasure, Jamie and Amy. That rhymes, doesn't it?
It does. We get
it that does. Yeah, people don't realize it.
Yeah, I wanted her to legally change her name, but she wouldn't do it. So
yeah, to Shmamey.
But I do appreciate having you. I look forward to seeing you again in the near future. Everybody, that was Dr. Ben Oldroyd, who's a professor in behavioral genetics, School of Life and Environmental Sciences at the University of Sydney in Australia. He's currently on sabbatical at the Institute of Advanced Studies in Berlin, Germany. And he was talking to us about using trap drones to discover the density of wild honeybee colonies in an area.
Have questions or comments? Don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at UF Honeybee Lab.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this segment of Two Bees and a Podcast. One of the things that I get a lot of questions about here at the University of Florida is the impact of Nosema on colonies and how to control Nosema in colonies. And frankly, I know a fair amount about Nosema, but oftentimes not enough to be able to help the beekeepers quickly and directly, because a lot of beekeepers believe their colonies are struggling with this particular issue. We struggle with some of the control options available for this pathogen. So one of the things that we wanted to do at Two Bees in a Podcast is bring in one of our own local experts to talk about that, this disease. And that local expert is Dr. Cameron Jack. He's a lecturer here in the Entomology and Nematology Department at the University of Florida. Cameron, thank you for joining us on Two Bees in a Podcast.
Well, thanks again. I'm glad to be back. It's been a while. You and Amy have had such a good thing going that I'm just worried now that I'm going to mess it up.
Yeah, I think, Cameron, the issue is that your name doesn't rhyme with either of our names. So yeah. It's easy to be Jamie and Amy, but Jamie and Cameron just doesn't roll off the tongue.
Yeah, it just doesn't roll off. Yeah.
Well, Cameron, I mean, obviously, you know this, but one of the reasons we brought you on is that you are what I consider an expert on Nosema. In fact, anytime I get questions about Nosema, I almost always come and ask you that question, and then I will answer the beekeeper basically with whatever you tell me. So could you just very quickly tell me how you got interested in studying Nosema? I know that you did a Nosema-based project when you were a master's student at Oregon State. Could you tell me how you got into that line of research in the first place?
So at the time, I was finishing my undergraduate degree, and I was just looking at different opportunities across the country, and I was emailing a lot of honeybee researchers, and there were a number of different projects that people were proposing, but I really liked this idea of studying Nosema, which I ended up going to work with Dr. Ramesh Sagili at Oregon State University. And I guess I was just drawn to Nosema because this was, at least at the time, a number of years ago, this was something that was relatively new. A lot of beekeepers were really worried about it. And really my whole graduate career, I just wanted to do something that I thought was really going to be beneficial and helpful to beekeepers. So that's kind of how I gravitated towards Nosema. And then once I kind of got into it, I just found it really interesting, and I enjoyed my time looking under a microscope all day.
So Cameron, I've actually never done a project on Nosema myself, at least when I was a graduate student. I've done a couple things since then while working at University of Florida, but I would say without question that I'm not an expert on this topic. So before we really go further into, you know, the control, how this impacts bees and beekeeping, could you tell our listeners what Nosema is in the first place?
Sure. So Nosema is basically a single-celled organism that is a fungal pathogen. So they basically is what it sounds like. I mean, they are classified as microsporidia, which, I mean, they are microspores. That's what they exist as. And if you follow the levels of classification down all the way to genus, there is a genus of microsporidia called Nosema. And this particular genus will infect insects primarily. And so there are different species of Nosema, and they will infect different insects in different ways. And we actually have a few different species that will just affect honeybees specifically. But these microspores will get into the guts of the insect, and they basically hijack ATP, which is going to be the energy of cells. And then they have hijack some other nutrients and to just replicate within their gut cells. And that's basically how they exist. And then, you know, that organism will basically poop them out somewhere, and they'll maybe get into the water, and then another insect will pick that up once they drink that water, and then it just kind of spreads all over again.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy and scary sounding. It's one of the things that I think a lot of people don't know when they get into bees and beekeeping is that honeybees have a lot of pests and pathogens that need to be addressed. And when we talk about things like Nosema, and I'm just listening to you talk about it, to me, there's a lot of parallels between it and some of the human intestinal issues that we get. I mean, I often teach Nosema as if it's the bee version of cholera, right? It gets into their system, causes a lot of digestive issues, and then it spread through fecal material, you know, because of, in the human case with cholera, diarrhea, but with bees, it's very similar. So before we go to all of that and get in the weeds of that, you mentioned that Nosema is a genus of the single-celled microsporidia that impacts a lot of different insects. And you mentioned that there are some species specifically that affect honeybees. So how many Nosema species exist that impact honeybees directly? And what are those species?
Sure. So you have three different species that have been found to infect honeybees. So you have Nosema apis, and now this one is been, you know, very well studied. This has been around for a long time. I think it was first described in the early 1900s. And so there's been quite a bit of research done on Nosema apis. And then the next species that came to be discovered was called Nosema serrana. And this is, you might recognize that name serrana from the Asian honeybee Apis serrana. So you've got Nosema serrana came from Apis serrana. And then what happens is you have beekeepers are moving honeybee colonies all across the world, and you kind of have these overlapping of regions that you don't normally see. Then you have these two very similar species, Apis mellifera and Apis serrana, and they start sharing each other's pathogens, basically. And so that's when we start to see a shift. We see Nosema serrana start showing up in Apis mellifera. And then once everybody started looking for it, about 2006 is when Nosema serrana was first discovered to be in Apis mellifera. Then everybody started looking for it. And then lo and behold, it happened to be all over the world already. It's just that people didn't know about it. And so those are the two primary ones that are very heavily studied. There's back in 2017, so just a few years ago now, there was another Nosema species that was described affecting Apis mellifera. So far, it's only been found in Uganda, and it was called Nosema pneumoniae. And so you've got these three species, the third one being so relatively new and that nobody really knows very much about it. It just, and nobody, there's no reason to think that it's that much different than the other two species. But so there are three of them that are in existence right now.
So that's a fascinating story. I will tell you, when I first started keeping bees, you know, literally 30 years ago, almost to the month, I was told by my mentor that I had to worry a lot specifically about Nosema apis. And so everything I learned about managing Nosemas with Nosema apis, things to look out for, how to treated all of that stuff. And then as you mentioned, somewhere around 2006, 2007, you know, we had this worldwide issue that was brought to attention, these high gross loss rates of managed honeybee colonies in the US that originally was called colony collapse disorder, but now is broadened to be called colony losses. And I remember right about that time is when Nosema serrana was discovered. And very early on, it was implicated in a lot of the deaths that we were seeing with these widespread losses of bees. But then people backtracked on that and people started trying to really tease out what the differences between Nosema apis and Nosema serrana were, how responsible serrana was for bee losses. It was at that time, Cameron, that I just got more and more and more confused about Nosema, because it seems like every paper that came out would contradict the previous paper. Nosema apis is hard to find now, and it probably has been supplanted by Nosema serrana. Now Nosema serrana is the one that's killing bees. Wait a minute, it doesn't kill bees. Wait a minute, it does kill bees. And then lo and behold, just 3 years ago, we've got this new Nosema, Nosema pneumoniae, named after our colleague Peter Newman in Europe. And now we're not sure what it does. And so there's all of this confusion, as far as I'm concerned, about Nosema. So let me ask, you know, is it true that Nosema apis is harder to find in North America and has largely been supplanted by Nosema serrana?
So that's a great question. You make a lot of great points about how confusing it can all be with all the research that's come out in the last even decade and a half. So to answer your question, yes, at least that's what it seems like. When we when people are monitoring and actually looking for Nosema in their colonies, by and large now they're finding Nosema serrana in North America. And so it does seem that Nosema serrana has kind of taken its place as the number one Nosema species and has kind of displaced Nosema apis. Now, Nosema apis is still around. And just to make things even more complicated and confusing, Jamie, you can have bees that are simultaneously infected with Nosema apis and Nosema serrana. So it gets really mixed, but it seems that by and large, if you're doing maybe something like quantitative PCR, so we're looking molecularly and trying to quantify, you know, how much we have. We might see both species, Nosema apis and Nosema serrana, but you tend to see a bit more Nosema serrana.
I mean, all of this is interesting to me. One of the things I want to do is kind of drill into this impact on bees thing. Like I said, with Nosema apis, I felt like we all knew what it was supposed to do to bees. If you look at the old books, you know, it tended to be a problem, more of a problem in winter. You'd get in colonies that were heavily infected. A lot of the worker bees would exit those colonies, especially in later winter, and defecate the moment they leave the hive. So you'd get this fecal streaking on the front of the hive that was very characteristic, or at least said to be characteristic, of Nosema apis. But then along comes Nosema serrana, and it's this mystery pathogen. All the bees seem to have it, or at least a majority of colonies seem to have it. Some colonies seem to suffer from it, others not. So let's drill down a little bit and talk about it. You've already mentioned a bit about what Nosema does to bees, how it gets in the bees' midgut and competes. It literally gets into the cells of bees and competes for energy resources and reproduces in cells. But what does this do to the overall colony? And is every colony that has Nosema going to display signs of infection? Are they all doomed?
Good question. So let me start with that first one. So what is it actually doing to the colony? Well, if you look at an individual bee that is infected with Nosema, so it gets into those guts. And as we said, it's stealing resources, and it basically is starting to drain that bee. So what will happen is you have an individual bee that is getting hungry because they're getting drained, basically. And so they are eating and consuming more food. But at the same time, during this process of replication inside the bee's midgut, those Nosema are replicating to the point where they're actually bursting open and destroying the honeybee's gut's cells. And so the bee is hungry and it's eating more, but it can't actually absorb more of those nutrients. So it actually kind of continues this cycle of making it hungry and more and more hungry. And then think about, I mean, knowing the dynamics of a honeybee colony, there are some important bees that don't actually feed themselves, right? The queen being the most important, that she's being tended to by workers. But when you have a bunch of hungry bees, you see this kind of behavioral shift where they're not actually sharing food as readily as they normally would because they're feeling more hungry. And then what can happen in a really severe infection is you can have bees that are not tending to the queen as well. And then, you know, when mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy, right? So you can have some some really drastic colony effects when the queen is not being able to be fed and she's not producing or she's not egg laying. You have bees that are not sharing their food. So things can tend to go south really quickly when bees become really infected. Now, something really interesting that as one of my projects as a master's student, it's a terrible project and it makes me like kind of shiver a little bit thinking about it. It was actually a really good project. It was just a lot of work. But what we did was we created these colonies where we were marking bees individually and we were emerging them in the lab. So, and then we were creating these colonies of just completely marked bees. And so I knew the age of all the bees in the colony. And then we would introduce some Nosema spores to them. And then we would basically kind of give it a period of time. And then I would harvest that entire colony and look at the guts of each bee in that colony. So it was just a tremendous amount of work. But what we were able to see is that, you know, when we have these Nosema infections, it's not even a colony that is what we would consider to be like very infected, you'll tend to have these bees that just have crazy numbers. I mean, we're talking, you know, 50 million spores in one bee. And then, you know, we only see like maybe 10% of those bees that are actually infected. So it's not so much that all the bees get infected, but you might have some bees that are incredibly infected, and then it can spread pretty fast. With Nosema apis, the route of infection from bee to bee tends to be, as you mentioned, at least what we currently think, is that it tends to be kind of like a fecal oral route. So you have these bees that have dysentery, and then, you know, you have some that might actually defecate inside the hive, or they might leave and defecate just on the front of the hive or something. And you have bees, I mean, they're very hygienic. They're going to try to clean it up. And when they're cleaning it up, they're going to become infected. And that's how it will continue to spread. Nosema serrana, on the other hand, is thought to not cause as dysentery as much. To make it even more complicated, it's you've got kind of an oral to oral route. So as bees are feeding each other and sharing food via trophallaxis, they are passing some of those Nosema spores. And so it can kind of take hold and take root inside of a colony. And then what will happen, kind of large scale effects, is you'll have reduced longevity. So the bees aren't living as long. You have usually a reduction in the amount of food that they're storing, because again, they're going to be really hungry. They're not going to be storing as well for winter. And then you kind of move into winter or in the fall months, when there's not as many nectar resources available. The risk of starvation is really high, because you have bees that are extra hungry and they don't have as much food stores. So lots of colony losses that you tend to see in the winter and in the early spring.
Yeah, this whole thing is just, it's mind-boggling to me, because back in the past when I've done that, there's one or two projects looking at Nosema, it seems like we found them in every colony. So then you're wondering if there's like just universal poor performance in those colonies because they're all infected with Nosema. But then you hear, you know, of some reports where they're just got it, like what you mentioned, even high loads, but there seem to be no impacts. I feel like there's so much more we need to know specifically about Nosema serrana, which of course is why people are beginning to study it all around the world. And as you know, Cameron, all of this is good. The science part's good. The biology is all good. But ultimately, a lot of our listeners are beekeepers and they want to know what they can do about it. So let's talk a little bit about that. Is Nosema controllable? If so, how? And what are some of your recommendations regarding addressing this issue? You know, beekeepers are going to want to know what they can do to stop Nosema before it impacts their colonies negatively.
So this is something that it's been on my mind a lot, and something that over the years, as I've received a lot of these questions about, okay, what do we do about it? And it's just kind of sad to report, like, I just don't really have a great answer to that question. So there's an antibiotic out there with the active ingredient being something called fumagillin. And this was in one product that was readily available, and then it went away. The manufacturer stopped producing it. And then there's been other products that have kind of come out on the market that have used this active ingredient. But, you know, there's been some studies that have shown that Nosema serrana, for instance, has kind of like escaped fumagillin control. So the antibiotic is no longer really effective at controlling it. And from my own personal experience, I hate to go here a little bit, but maybe a little bit anecdotal evidence. I mean, I've had to do a number of projects. I've seen that, you know, using a fumagillin tends to bring down the Nosema levels. Nevertheless, it doesn't really wipe it out. And it doesn't really, in my opinion, matter so much. This is kind of a tricky thing in terms of monitoring, because, you know, if somebody asks me, should I monitor for Varroa? I mean, I'm just shaking them saying, yes, you need to monitor for Varroa. You need to know your mite counts so that you can make appropriate management decisions. But when I talk about Nosema, I still teach my students how to monitor for Nosema, because I think it's a worthwhile skill, and it's something that, you know, maybe later we'll find that it is really important. But at least right now, it doesn't seem that, you know, knowing your Nosema counts really correlates to very much. I mean, we don't know what a great threshold is. Is it 1 million spores per bee? Is that when we need to to, is that when your colony is in danger? Well, we don't really know. And not necessarily, because like, again, you know, as I said before, we've seen that you can have some bees that are just crazy infected. And then a lot, the majority of the bees could be perfectly healthy. And so basing it off of spore counts is not super useful. And basing your monitoring off of proportions of infected bees, in my opinion, would probably be more useful, but that's a lot of work to go through bee by bee in a single colony and to come up with a good proportion. So there's not a really effective way of monitoring, and there's not really an effective way of treating. So now everybody's just panicked because I just told everybody kind of the horrors of Nosema, but I can share something that hopefully will, you know, provide some level of comfort. So one of the studies that I did for my master's, and I have seen has been demonstrated by others as well throughout the world, is that when you have honeybees that are have access to good nutrition, so they are healthy otherwise because they're eating well, they have enough pollen, they have enough nectar and honey, so they're otherwise nutritionally set, they actually tend to have more Nosema spores than those bees that are malnourished. And when I first saw this, I was just freaking out. I'm like, oh my goodness, something must've been wrong with my study. And then the more that we, you know, thought about this, we're like, well, think about what Nosema is. It's an obligate parasite. It's going to have to rely on its host for energy and for nutrients. And so if you have a malnourished bee, the Nosema can also not replicate as effectively. So you have these healthy or bees that have access to good nutrition. They end up having more Nosema. However, we do see that they will survive better than malnourished bees that are maybe have lower Nosema counts, but still have Nosema. And so really what I tell beekeepers is the best thing you can probably do is to just make sure your bees have access to good nutrition, that you're feeding them when they need to be fed. That you're putting them in areas that have abundant floral resources. And I know this is one of those things that a lot of beekeepers are probably rolling their eyes right now thinking, yeah, obviously, Cameron, if we could do that, we would do it. But, you know, if you can do that, then I feel like, and if you are doing that, I feel like you don't really probably need to worry about Nosema too much in most cases.
It's really funny that you say that, because I often have felt unable to address beekeepers who said, look, you can tell me how to find it. You can tell me what, you know, how to quantify it, but you can't really tell me how to control it. And that's true. And oftentimes what I default to is, well, you know, we need to control the things in bee colonies that we can control, varroa, queens, nutrition, things like that. And it's funny that you mentioned the link to nutrition, because as you are well aware, a lot of beekeepers report one of the most significant stressors impacting their colonies is nutrition. And so then we start to get into chicken and egg arguments. Well, you know, is nutrition a stressor for bees because Nosema is an underlying presence there all the time? Or is Nosema a problem for bees because bees become nutritionally stressed? Or are both an impact because bees have consumed pollen that are, you know, laced with pesticide? So then we start to question, you know, what's important to control first? Or we get these issues that, you know, who's impacting who? So at the end of the day, throughout all of this interview with you, one of the things that just kept popping up in my mind is, you know, we need to study Nosema a lot more. And beyond that, we need to study Nosema control a lot more. So that leads into kind of one of these final questions that I have for you, which is, what does need to be done about Nosema? What more do we need to know? What future research is needed on this topic?
So I think in my mind, the very first thing that we would really want to do is to be able to find the threshold. I mean, find at what point of our Nosema levels, I mean, is that an issue? And are we quantifying this, you know, correctly? Before we even worry about controls, in my opinion, I feel like we just need to understand the dynamics of this infection better to be able to understand how we can monitor it. And I preach this pretty hard, I guess, when I'm talking about varroa, is that it's so important to monitor because, you know, based on what your results are of your monitoring, that might, you know, determine what type of control and what level at which you are controlling a varroa. And so we don't really have that anywhere near that for Nosema. We just have, you know, like, as I said, you can just kind of crush up a bunch of bees, look at their guts. And people usually do that in like one big sample. maybe of like 100 or 50 bees or something like that, and then kind of look at it. But you might be pulling in just, you know, you might have one or two bees that are really skewing your results. So coming up with a good way to monitor and set some thresholds, I feel would be really important. And then you move into more of the control. So what do we do about it? Well, maybe there are some things that are non-chemical controls, just some kind of cultural type of controls, you know, the way that we are managing, the way that we are feeding, the way that we are providing them access to water and things like that. I'm just kind of throwing some ideas out here, but those are some questions that I think people would need to know. And then we kind of move into the chemical controls. Okay, so let's say that we've done all these other things and we still have high Nosema infections. Now, what do we do? Well, we pretty much have been relying solely on just one antibiotic that may or may not be, you know, super effective. And so there is a need to kind of look for other alternatives. But, you know, I would probably put some of those other topics, you know, first before we focus too heavily on all the controls. But I mean, that's not how it works for Varroa. I don't expect people to back up that far to work on those types of research questions for Nosema either. I know that there are lots of labs and groups that are looking at new alternatives to fumagillin for effective Nosema control.
And I think that's needed, Cameron, because, you know, a lot of our listeners are in countries around the world that don't have access to chemical options, or whose countries may not even allow that option with regard to addressing bee diseases and pests in the first place. So I agree with you completely. We need to know a lot more about these diseases, and maybe a lot more about thresholds, like what you said, and certainly a lot more control strategies need to be developed. As always in the research world, there's more to do and more to know. I guess that keeps us busy.
It does. And it's one of the reasons that I'm, you know, so excited to be in the field that I am, because there's always something to do, but it also is something that confuses my family sometimes when I'm talking. They're like, oh, what are you going to do for Christmas break? I'm like, I have Christmas off, you know, the rest of the time I've got something to do always, you know, there's always research, even if I'm not teaching, you know, there's something to be done all the time. So it's exciting and it's exhausting and it's fun.
So Cameron, I really appreciate you joining us. I think one of the take-home messages about this Nosema, we as of, you know, like a lot of other things, we need to know more. We've got to get a handle on this to help reduce the stress of this particular pathogen in bee colonies. And I know that a lot of people around the world are looking at this, so that's certainly encouraging. And there's a lot more that I think we need to share with our listeners about this topic. So we're going to have you back on in the future, maybe some other scientists who are experts on Nosema as well, to talk about a lot of the different aspects of Nosema. So Cameron, thank you so much for joining us on this segment of Two Bees in a Podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely. Everybody, that was Dr. Cameron Jack, who's a lecturer here in the Entomology and Nematology Department at the University of Florida.
It's everybody's favorite game show, Stump the Chump.
Okay, so it's that question and answer time. Jamie, I've got three questions, and I've only prepped you for two, and I've got one surprise one.
You got me nervous because you said it was a surprise, and now I'm like totally worried. But go ahead, let's get through the two I think that I know are coming, and we'll see what that third one is.
All right, fine. Okay, so in the first question, in a recent podcast, you had stated that honey super shouldn't be installed on a colony during mite treatment. So this person has been using a 2-inch shim that is to be installed on the hive to allow bees full access to the treatment. But, you know, now they're wondering if they're doing this wrong or maybe it was a mistake.
Yeah, basically I can explain what happened. So I was saying that many mite treatments cannot be applied to colonies per the label, right, of these treatments when you are making marketable or honey that's to be consumed by humans. So when I said the word honey super, I was basically saying supers that you were putting on colonies for the purpose of producing consumable or marketable honey. In this case, you can actually have supers on colonies while treatments are in, if you follow the label and the label permits you to do that. However, in those cases, you can't eat the honey in most instances. So what I do, you know, my standard colony, for example, is a deep brood box and a medium super that I leave on all year long for the bees as their food. So it's okay for me to have that on during mite treatments because I never intend to eat that honey. Again, if the label permits, the label is ultimately the law. So what this listener was describing was a situation where he or she wasn't supering for marketable honey purposes. Sure. They just had a superone to give a space around the treatment, et cetera. All of that's fine. Again, at the end of the day, the general rule of thumb is, and again, you've got to follow the label. I have to say that 1,000 times, but the general rule of thumb is you can't treat for varroa with most treatments and extract the honey that is produced in that colony while those treatments are in the hive. So that's, sure, that's the key there.
All right. So the second question, I'm not even going to edit this out. I don't know how to say the word. What was the Demarie?
Yep.
Demarie. All right. So this beekeeper has been a beekeeper for 8 years, and they've been trying to find better methods for swarm controls. So they've tried brood box rotations, a Demarie method. The problem is the bees keep filling back in those empty brood frames with honey. So you end up with half-filled frames and then nothing to return back down to the brood chamber. Is there a better way to prevent this, or, you know, is this person doing the process wrong?
Well, what I would do is I would do a completely different strategy for controlling swarming altogether. I'll tell you what I do in my own colonies at home. And again, this is just an opinion as a beekeeper, not as a fact as a scientist. But I clip my queen's wings so that they can't swarm. They physically cannot fly from the hive. They might try, but they can't. I also, during production season, go through my colonies every 7 to 10 days to remove all the queen cells, and I super colonies appropriately during swarm season to alleviate some of that density in the hive that's leading to some of the stimulus, right? When there's a lot of bees in the nest, they want to swarm, especially if the honey flow is coming on. So I super appropriately, I cut queen cells every 7 to 10 days, and I clip my queens, and those three things tend to solve most of my swarming issues. There are lots of other strategies for swarm control. You mentioned the Demarie method and others. A lot of things can be used. A lot of the commercial beekeepers will split colonies, et cetera. I just wanted to tell you the three things that I focus on during swarm season. I've actually written a document about swarm control and managed bee colonies, and we'll make sure and link that document in the show notes so that you can see some other tips and secrets about trying to manage swarm. I want to give out one little final caveat with this comment, is that swarming is reproduction at the colony level, and reproduction is hard to control on anything. Mm-hmm. So sometimes even the best swarm management strategies will fail. So, sure, you know, I will tell you, for every 10 colonies that I clip the queens and cut the queen cells and super appropriately, I might lose one colony to a swarm, probably less than that. But you know, I would still say that occasionally you're going to have colonies swarm despite your best efforts. But again, okay, have a look at that document linked in the show notes, and it'll explain some of the methods that I just talked about here.
I was about to say, it's an EDIS document, correct? So I'll be sure to link that.
Absolutely.
Definitely. Okay, so I had a meeting with the tropical beekeepers the other day, and one of the members said that when you work Africanized bees, people, I just want to make sure I get this right. Okay, so people will breathe through a 50-foot tube to avoid the carbon monoxide so that the bees don't know that you're coming. Have you ever heard about this before? Is that a common practice? I did not know how to answer that. And I was like, I'll have to ask Jamie on the podcast.
So there's a couple things at play here. Now, okay, I'm going to answer your question directly first. I have never heard that. So that doesn't mean it's not true. It just means I've not heard it. But yeah, but it's, if it's true, it's built on the premise that when bees start attacking a would-be intruder to their nest, they often focus in on dark colors or carbon dioxide emissions. And so in the case of carbon dioxide emissions, right, they're coming out of our nose and mouth, so bees will often concentrate their attacks there. So the premise behind that question is actually really interesting and correct. I just don't know if people actually do that management practice. Usually what most people do, who I know who work African bees or live in an area where African bees are the dominant bee, they'll use full bee suits and mess loads of smoke. They'll also do things like keep colonies on single hive stands so that you're upsetting one colony and not all the colonies on the stand and things like that. But generally speaking, they suit up really well and they smoke the bees a lot. Those are the two main things. That does, again, I want to say that that doesn't mean that they don't do this breathing thing, but I've just never heard of it.
Yeah, I didn't either. And I thought it was really funny. And they were like, you need to ask Dr. Ellis, but don't tell him beforehand. I'm like, all right, but I won't tell him.
That's okay. Like I said, it may be true. I'm not saying it's not. All I'm saying is that I've never heard of it before. So for what that's worth.
That's fair. All right. Well, I'm sure there's someone doing that out there. So anyway, yeah, that was great. We have a lot of questions. For some reason, the past week, we've had a ton more questions come in. So
keep asking those questions. Yeah. And we'll keep having something to talk about.
Yeah. And then, well, and something else that we just started was I had just received a voice message on Anchor. So if you all are listening to us through our Anchor page, which is the link that's linked directly, you know, straight from our Facebook and straight from our Instagram, you can actually leave voice messages for us. And so what we'll try to do is incorporate some of those voice messages into the Q&A section so that we can answer them while we're receiving them. So there are definitely ways that you all can ask questions, whether that be through social media or email or just doing a recording. That would be fun too. So we look forward to seeing how you all start asking questions to us. Hey everyone, thanks for listening today. We'd like to give an extra special thank you to our podcast coordinator, Lauren Goldstein, and to our audio engineer, James Weaver. Without their hard work, Two Bees in a Podcast would not be possible.
For more information and additional resources for today's episode, don't forget to visit the UF IFAS Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory's website, ufhoneybee.com. Do you have questions you won't answer it on air? If so, email them to honeybee@ifas.ufl.edu or message us on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at UF Honeybee Lab. While there, don't forget to follow us. Thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast.